Welcome to the Fanboy Strike Back with the Review Podcast, episode 18.
Episode 18, I'm David.
I'm Eric.
And every week we get together, we read the comics that came out, and we pick what we thought was the best book of the week. We go to our website, fanboystrikeback.com, and we write a little review there. And then we do this podcast also every week. We talk about that best book, all the other books that came out. This week we're also going to be talking about the last couple of episodes of Heroes, and we're going to be giving you guys our review of the Spider-Man 3 DVD. We're going to talk about everything in all these reviews, so if you do not like spoilers, you're going to want to pause the podcast and come back later. But that being said, Eric had the pick for the best book of the week, so Eric, why don't you tell us what you had?
Well, it was Halloween, it was a dark and spooky comic book day. Had to go with something dark and spooky. Had to go with Batman, number 670. This is the written by Grant Morrison, art by Tony Daniel, and this is the prelude to the Resurrection of Ra's al Ghul crossover event that's going to be happening in the Slinker and Batman books. First and foremost, I'm going to start off with the artwork. The artwork by Tony Daniel, it's very Kubert-esque, I'd say, but there's something kind of old-fashioned about it for some reason. Like, it's somewhere between Jim Lee, somewhere with Andy Kubert. But there's some shots where he just kind of cloaks himself with his cape or sticks to the shadows. It feels very very old-fashioned in it. And it kind of reminded me, actually, of Norm Breyfogle's work back in the early 90s when he worked with Alan Grant on the book. And I think, for some reason, and I don't know why that really stuck out to me, but it kind of just gave me a old-fashioned feeling. It kind of made me remember what reading these books as a kid felt like. It was kind of spooky. So with that, I've been no stranger to criticize Grant Morrison's work on this title so far.
Yeah.
And this is actually something I'm excited for. I've kind of said my piece about Damian. I don't really care for him, but I'm really interested to see that story develop. This is the first time we actually see someone who's claiming to be Ra's al Ghul back from the grave. He's kind of all swathed in bandages and stuff like that. Apparently he's kind of a worse for wear. But he comes back, he demands Talia's allegiance, and also Damian. And for those who read the Batman Annual, Ra's was supposed to kind of take over Damian's body at some point. And that was going to be the way that Ra's came back. And that plan is sullied. Damian's not, he's too headstrong. He's not going to allow it. So, and Damian also has this really kind of fierce loyalty to his dad, for some reason, for not really having known him. Like, Damian's walking around in the Robin costume that he stole.
Right.
And so I think that was kind of interesting, because, I don't know, Bruce really hasn't displayed much loyalty towards Damian for some reason, and yet Damian's really, like, really trying to prove himself to his father. So with that, Damian leaves on a quest to go. Actually, there was a really cool fight scene with Damian taking out some of the League of Assassins, but Damian now leaves to go find Bruce and warn Bruce that Ra's is back. So that left it in a very cool place. Like, I was, by the end of that book, there's a splash page, or not a splash page, but just a full page artwork of Damian in the Robin costume breaking through this window being chased by ninjas, and I was like, that's some great artwork right there. That's exciting. Like, I'm really excited to see where the story goes.
And yeah, I picked up this issue too, and I actually agreed with what you put in your review, is that this is probably the least annoying that we've ever seen Damian. But I still have always been so, like, on the fence about the whole character, because I just feel like, I don't know, I feel like if this is the son of Bruce and Talia, and he was raised a certain way, I just don't think that he would be, like, a brat. Like, I think he would be the exact opposite. Like, I feel like he would be, like, this very, very focused, driven young man.
Yeah, but
and
he
I
wasn't,
guess that
he wasn't really raised by Bruce, though. I mean, he was kind of grown up pampered, and, of course, his mother probably catered to every want that he had.
Yeah, but I don't want to see, like, Talia being, like, one of those desperate housewives mom. Like, I figured that he would have a very, very strict upbringing. And I think what they're doing is, like, I think that they're trying to draw a very, very big line between him and Tim, because him being raised the way that I figured he would be, he would end up a lot more like Tim Drake, and they can't make those two characters the same. So I think that's where it's going. But it was good to see him, like, in this issue, not being a complete, like, whiny brat, and, like, be, like, a likable character. And like you said, like, see him, like, really trying to prove himself to Bruce.
Yeah, I thought that was really, really exciting. And I agree, like, that's going to be the split between him and Tim, is they're both... Bruce is both the father figure to both of them. And what I wrote in my review was, I'm really excited to see where Damian is left at the end of this story. You know, I still can't really see them making him Robin, but...
No, of course,
but he really wants to be Robin, is the thing. Like, he wants to be partners with Bruce. So I'm really excited to see where they're going to end up putting Damian by the end of this story.
And well, what do you think? Do you think Damian is going to have... Do you think he is going to be a part of Batman? I mean, is he actually going to last, or
I think
is this going to be a fad?
If it's a fad, I think it's going to be like the Kyle Rayner fad and last for like 10 years. Like I could very easily see Damian taking up the role that Talia did, where originally she was conflicted between her love for Bruce and her loyalty to her father, and I think that's mm-hmm. going to be the same thing with Damian, is he's going to feel conflicted between maybe his loyalty to his father, and then I'm sure there's going to be some manipulation and some head games, because that's the way Ra's al Ghul works, and that's part of the one of the better parts of his character. He plays these mind games, and we've already seen in the teasers for the rest of the story that he's going to do that with Tim, and so I think there's going to be a lot of conflicting father-son family ties in this storyline that I'm really looking forward to seeing explored.
Well, so, if I had to pick a book of the week, do you have any idea what my guess would be?
Countdown to Final Crisis?
No.
Okay.
We'll go ahead and talk about that later.
No. Yeah, X-Men Messiah Complex Chapter 1 kicked off this week.
It did.
It was good.
Yeah, Brubaker wrote the first issue with Mark Silvestri. And this was just... This was so good.
It was damn good.
This was so good.
There were parts in this book where I was taken aback. I was like, whoa. Specifically, well, why don't you set up the story first, and I'll tell what parts I like about it.
Yeah, it's going off what I talked about last week about X-Men and how it's going straight into Messiah Complex, and that at this point, Sinister and the Marauders have knowledge of the future and have knowledge of a new mutant being born, the first mutant since M-Day, and they're going after this mutant. Meanwhile, they have taken away all these connections from the X-Men of knowing the future, so the X-Men have no clue that this mutant's about to be born. And so that picks up with Xavier using Cerebro and basically crying over the fact that there's no more mutants, and then all of a sudden, bam, a new mutant is born, and it hits him. So the X-Men obviously take off, and they go to this town, and the town is just destroyed. And you see remnants of the Marauders are there, and also remnants of the Purifiers, which is they're a branch that was led by William Stryker. You don't know what's going on. The town is just burning. There aren't any children around, which is kind of unsettling, so you're not sure what's going on. Did they kidnap children? Did they kill children? And, like, some very disturbing things come out of this, because you find out that it was a new mutant, and it wasn't a teenager, you know, going into adolescence that triggered the mutation, because that's normally how it works. It was actually a baby being born that was a mutant, and you see that there's a hospital, and that all the babies have been killed, except for one. So, Sinister has a baby. And that is, like, the worst news possible.
I mean, there were parts in this where, especially the part where they get to the town and just everyone's in flames, and that woman is carrying the charred remains of her daughter. Mm-hmm. And that was the part where I was like, I kind of sat back and was like, well, that's pretty intense for an X-Men book. It really made the gravity of the situation as far as, you know, the first new mutant in a long time, the fear of the whole thing against the mutants, it really brought that into sharp perspective and made it feel very important. Like, there's a reason why people are afraid of them. But also, it's very important that this child get into the right hands.
Yeah, I mean, they did a very good job in this first issue of, like, making sure it's known to everyone reading this book that, like, this new mutant really is this important. And, like, there are basically three different factions of people fighting just to get their hands on this mutant. Obviously, Sinister wants it to test and to do what he wants. The Purifiers want it because they want to destroy it. And the X-Men want it because the X-Men want to save him.
Yeah.
So it's just setting up the first issue. We have no idea what's going to happen so far. We just know that Sinister has a baby, and all that's been said is that, like, obviously they say this for every, you know, crossover, but they said that, like, you're going to be very, very surprised by the twist that you see in the story, and that really when it ends, like, you won't look at the X-Men the same way. So I don't know, like, I loved it. I'm so excited. Like I've been saying, I'm so excited for every episode of the podcast, but, like, I'm so giddy to have an X-Men event because it's been so long.
So Scott Summers seems like he's going to be a pretty big part. They did profiles at the end of the book, and they had one for Scott Summers. Mm-hmm. Do you think, as far as looking at the X-Men in a different way, it looks like he's... Do you think they're going to take him in a different direction as far as making him do something? Because they said basically all he wants, or all he's focused on right now, is survival.
Right.
And so...
I can see, like... I can basically see Scott doing anything to save this new mutant. Especially, like, at this point, Cable is not dead, I believe, but to Scott, he is. And then... It wasn't long ago that Scott lost Jean, and Cable is Scott's son, and Cable was taken from Scott as a baby also. So I think these are bringing up a lot of old feelings for him, and the fact that Sinister is involved, because Sinister has always had a deep connection to the Summers family. So I can really see him, you know, saying, like, the gloves are really off, and I can see him taking a darker turn. But I don't know, like, they've been really, really hush-hush about what's going to happen, but they just really, all they've said is that, like, things are going to happen that you just really wouldn't expect, and, like, they've said that some characters are going to, like, switch sides, and you'll be surprised by who that is.
Hmm. So. Yeah, it's exciting, like, it was just very well written and beautifully drawn, like, it was exactly as a first chapter should be, like, it got you interested in the story.
Yeah, that's great.
So, yeah, hats off. Like, I'm excited for the two big winter crossover events. They both look like they're going to be really good.
Yeah.
So, well, we teased it. Countdown.
Talk about good events. Yeah, let's keep going with that.
Countdown 26. This was the first issue of Countdown, where it is now Countdown to Final Crisis. And it was...
Okay, I have to say this. This makes... Reading this issue... makes me not want to buy Final Crisis.
I agree.
I can't.
This is ruining everything that it is touching.
This is so bad. Like, I've dropped the book, but I'm like, okay, I'll pick it up during certain times. Like, when I saw that Kyle Rayner was on it, I picked it up, and it was horrible. And I was like, alright, well, I know I'm going to pick up issue 26, because... it's Countdown to Final Crisis now, and I picked it up, and it's like, this book is so bad.
Well, the problem is, like, they're trying to create drama, like, the Karate Kid thing, like, he's carrying a virus, and, like, he's going to be a very important player to Darkseid, and, like, I still want to know what the hell Darkseid's involvement is in this. We don't even know.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is, I just don't care. Like, I don't care about Karate Kid. He's never been a character I've been invested in. I don't like the Legion. Jimmy Olsen, again... I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, that is never a character that I've been invested in. I don't think it's a character anyone's been invested in. He's always been
not
there.
In terms of him being a hero. No, definitely not.
But like, honestly, I have never met one comic book fan who's been like, I love Jimmy Olsen.
I love Jimmy Olsen.
So, like, he's always just kind of there, and people tolerate him, and and all that. Like, the Jason Todd thing, Kyle Rayner, Donna Troy thing.
Oh, jeez, that was so bad.
It's horrible, but that is the only reason why I'm reading this book, is because, like, personally, and this is not stemming from Countdown, but, I've been a fan of these characters for years. And yeah. So, like, I want to see something happen with Kyle and Donna. I want to see Jason Todd redeem himself and become Red Robin, because that's what's been teased. And so you got to kind of expect, like, well, it's got to happen eventually. Like, he can't be he just can't be an asshole forever.
It seems like, it really just seems like he's not even progressing. Like, it seems like there's going to be one issue where, like, all of a sudden he's going to become Red Robin, and it's not going to be, like, a journey to him, for him, like, getting to that point. It's just going to be like, oh, okay, well, we said that he's going to be Red Robin now, so here he is.
Right. And that's what's upsetting me, is because these stories, I think, individually handled on a more flexible time frame instead of weekly, I think all of these stories probably have potential to be pretty decent mini-series, like, you know, released once a month, maybe 4, 5, 6 issues long. They'd probably be okay. Or even better than okay. I think some of them have potential to be pretty damn good. But the thing is, they're just not, in this format, they're just not touched upon. And it's just, there's something missing. The magic of the weekly series that 52 had did not carry over to Countdown.
Oh, definitely not. Not at all.
And it's really sad. And this issue, we were now thrown together with a black-clad evil Superman that went to kill the Lex Luthor of Earth 15, who was a good guy.
Right.
It just, like, and that's the first thing we've seen of him. Like, I don't know where this Superman came from. I have no idea.
Yeah, what Earth he's from, and only thing that happened in this issue is that we found out that the monitors are going to go to war.
Yeah, and this is the problem of the multiverse being back, is the thing we've just uttered, and we've uttered it almost every podcast where we talk about Crisis or Countdown, is I don't know what Earth he's from. Like, I fucking hate the multiverse. This is ridiculous. Like, why?
And it's not even, like, that bad until, like, okay, there's a brand new black Superman. Okay, we don't know what Earth he's from. But it's also the fact that, like, there are a lot of new readers in DC Comics. And, like, I've been reading DC Comics since the death of Superman. And, like, the Crime Syndicate or whatever, I don't even know what they're called. I don't know what Earth they're from. I don't know stuff like that. Because, like, I am totally post-crisis, post-multiverse. And I've been that way for, like, you know, 10 years.
Yeah. Well, originally they were supposed to be from Earth 3, but that was the Crime Syndicate, and they're gone, and now this is supposed to be the Crime Society, which...
It's so confusing. Like, why bring back something this confusing? And then... I don't know.
Well,
I don't.
Here's the problem, is DC's not going to get any new readers from this storyline. And here's the problem, is, like, let's take a count real quickly about how many Supermans we have. We've killed off Earth 2 Superman. We have New Earth Superman running around now, which is our regular Superman. We have Kingdom Come Superman running around now. We've got black-suited evil Superman running around now. We've got Crime Society Superman running around. We've got Superboy or Superman Prime running around.
Superman Prime.
Like, that's... It's ridiculous. Like, I hate this. I hate multiple versions of different characters, or of the same character. So, as a DC fan, it's really hard to watch, because it's like watching them beat themselves in the head with the hammer on purpose.
Uh-huh.
And it's so frustrating. And I really, like, I don't know what Hail Mary could possibly get this story out of the gutter at this point.
So what are your thoughts right now on Final Crisis? What do you suspect is going to happen in Final Crisis? Do you have any idea?
The only thing I can think of is, like, there's going to be a war between, like, Monarch, Darkseid. It's going to be a Fate of the Galaxy type war. With the end result, I can't see him doing it so soon, but, like, it sounds like they might be ready to condense the multiverse back down into a universe again, the way the monitors were talking. And, God, I hope so. But, like, I'm just not excited about this event, because it's got such a bad taste in my mouth already. And so, like, I don't know. It's going to be horribly confusing. I think it's already hard enough for many fans even people our age to go back and read Crisis on Infinite Earths, because we were kind of just starting to get into comics at that point.
Oh man,
if not later.
When I didn't read Crisis at all until Infinite Crisis was going to come out, and I asked you, Eric, I was like, you know, can I borrow it and can I read it? And you're like, yeah, but it's going to be really confusing.
Yeah, it's
and it is the hardest. That's the hardest comic book I've ever read in my entire life, because it is all continuity, and it is all, like, it's completely based on the multiverse. Like, you jump from different Earths just like that, and I'm just like, what is going on? This makes absolutely no sense. And I've never understood the whole appeal of having alternate versions of the same character.
Well,
like,
because it wasn't created because of that. Like, it was...
Exactly.
The multiverse was created by accident, because...
Everything was different. They just had these different... they had these different heroes, but they weren't together. They were all from these different eras.
Well, it was a publishing thing, because Batman and Superman had survived the comic book crisis in the 50s and stuff like that, in 60s. But then, like, the older characters like Flash and Green Lantern had kind of gone by the wayside, and then they rebooted the characters in the 60s with, Hal Jordan and Barry Allen, who didn't look anything like Alan Scott or Jay Garrick. And so... Right. With this, they had to come up with some kind of, like, why is Batman and Superman running around with these characters in the 30s when Batman and Superman are the same age and running around with these characters in the 60s? That was how they came up with the multiverse idea. And then it just exploded from there as DC obtained properties, like the Shazam family was a different comic book company altogether. They acquired that and made that a whole different Earth. And, you know, and so on. Same with the Charleston characters who ended up templates for the Watchmen characters. Like, it just...
I think that, you know, and it's probably going to upset some people, because obviously there's people out there who are fans of the multiverse, but I think that maybe DC had the idea that they could bring them back to multiverse, and everything's so good with about continuity nowadays, and their editors are you know, so good. The multiverse can never... Honestly, I don't think it could ever work. You can never have the multiverse and it, like, work for readers, because it's just too confusing. It takes you out of the story so quick. And I know that there's people who love the multiverse, but...
Writers of DC.
I think the people who love the multiverse are slim to none. I mean, those fans, they're not really around all that much. And even the people who grew up with it and liked it, they don't like it anymore, because it's just too confusing.
Yeah, it's just... I think it's another part of that whole Silver Age thing that a lot of the comic book creators at DC were trying to go for. And that's just not flying with younger readers. And young, by younger, I say anyone from, you know, starting age of comics up to maybe their late 20s.
Oh, yeah.
So, I groan at this title.
Let's segue over into Justice Society of America number 10.
This is a book, I mean, I've loved this book since it started. This storyline is something that I'm trying very hard to like.
Okay.
However, I'm just not that invested in it again. So far, bringing the Superman back seems like it's a gimmick to get readership to this title. There hasn't been a point to it yet. We don't know how he came to this Earth or why he's here. It's just, and we got some really nice splash pages with Alex Ross art. Being like,
yeah.
but really, more or less, like, they just kind of talk about the Kingdom Come storyline, and it's more or less just to sit back and say, hey, remember that? That was cool. Remember that? You know, it makes you remember how cool Kingdom Come was, but
right.
I understand there's some conflict with Power Girl, and because she just recently lost her cousin there to Superman, and Kingdom Come Superman looks a lot like him, and now we're back into multiple Superman. It's just irritating.
Yeah, I thought a couple things were pretty weird. I mean, it was odd because you saw the page of Bruce seeing the Kingdom Come Superman, and then looking at the ring, and that being referenced all the way back to the first arc of Batman Superman.
Mm-hmm.
But that was like, what, 4 years ago?
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago, and so I don't think that there's... I mean, obviously, writers throw stuff in there. They throw in some plot holes, you know, and so another writer can pick it up later. But I always felt like something as big as that happening in Batman Superman really needed to be addressed sooner. So I thought that that page and this issue was kind of forced, like seeing Bruce in the Batcave and being like, oh, now we have to be reminded of Batman Superman. I really liked the dynamic between Kingdom Come Superman and the rest of the JSA, because it's very odd and refreshing for him being in New Earth, you know, because the heroes are heroic.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really cool, like, how he took that, and, like, how he was kind of humbled by it and everything. I just don't know where this is going at all. Like,
yeah.
Like you said, like, why is he here? What's going on?
It just seems...
And, you know...
It just seems gimmicky to me. And like, it could get very good soon. I'm not going to drop the title by any means, because I am interested to see where it goes. But for right now, like, I just can't muster up a whole lot of excitement for it. I'm just kind of like, eh, you know.
But, okay, but this being the JSA book, what do you think? Do you think that this is something, like, is this something that has to do with Countdown, that has to do with Final Crisis? Is this a tie-in, or is this just, like, a self-contained story?
Before I would have said self-contained story, because it was being billed as, like, this is the sequel to Kingdom Come, and God, they should never have said that. Because that's immediately going to make it not live up to anything.
Yeah.
But now it's like, okay, it's not... Kingdom Come isn't an Elseworlds story anymore. It's an actual...
Part of the multiverse.
And so now it's just like, damn it, I don't know anymore. I can never tell. Like, it could very easily be a tie-in, and it might not. We might not even figure that out until the last issue of the story.
Well, and then we had Jay Garrick and Wally West go and get the cosmic treadmill again, and now Jay is talking about how he wants to travel to a parallel Earth. So, is he going to go to the Kingdom Come Earth to try to get Superman back there? This is where it's getting...
See?
It's going to get confusing.
Just my eyeballs roll back in my head and I black out.
Yeah.
What else you got?
The last book I wanted to talk about was New X-Men Academy number 43.
Okay.
And I've talked about New X-Men and why I love it, and I just love it because it's like a teen drama with superheroes. You know, it's like Saved by the Bell meets the X-Men. And we had more of the same, and the reason why I love this issue so much is that as an African-American, I always like seeing other African-American in comic books. Like, obviously, I always gravitate towards those characters. And when New X-Men started, there was a character named David who I think has one of the coolest mutant powers ever. And his mutant power was that he could absorb the skills and the knowledge of people close to him. But as soon as those people left, then he would lose those skills. So if Wolverine was near him, he would obviously like have that sense of survival, he would have those fighting skills, but as soon as Wolverine left, he wouldn't have any more.
Mm.
Whenever the Beast is around, he's super smart. When Hank's gone, it leaves him. And it was just like, it's a really, really cool power, and it's very like, it's something like, it's kind of normal, but it has like that little tweak on it, because it's not absorbing their powers, it's just absorbing their skills and their knowledge. And after M-Day, he lost his powers, and so he's been just a human. He's still been part of the book, but he's been a human, and he's just been there, because he's always been a very important part of the book, but since M-Day, he's just kind of been there because he was important. He hasn't really been a factor in the team anymore. And so he's dating this a girl named Nori, who's a part of New X-Men 2, and she's been really worried about him ever since he lost his powers, and so she's kind of worried that she's going to put him in danger and he's going to end up getting killed. So this being a teen drama, she kisses someone else in front of David and hopes that David will break up with her and that David will leave the school and that he'll be out of harm. So she's trying, you know, throw herself on the cross. And it kind of has the opposite effect. David goes to the Cuckoos, who were Grant Morrison's invention. They're basically like clones of the White Queen, so they have telepathic powers. And they're like, well, we can't give you your powers back, but what we can do is that we can help you retain the skills that you would have like previously absorbed throughout, like until this point. So they do that for him, and so David comes back to the team, and so he basically has Wolverine's fighting skills, and he has, you know, Hank's knowledge, and he has every single skill that he had absorbed to that point, but he can retain it now. So I was really, really happy, because I was really worried that after M-Day and after he lost his powers, that he was just going to be pretty much written off, and that wasn't the case. And so he is still human, but he's part of the X-Men, and so I'm really excited about it. But, yeah, I can't say enough good things about the book, because it just, like, it's a very lighthearted teen book. It's very funny, and especially in the X-Men, you know, universe, you need something like that, because, like, we're talking about with Messiah Complex and everything. Everything is so serious with the X-Men. It's so serious. So it's nice to have this lighthearted companion to it.
Well, cool. Okay, well, I think that does it on our books this week. So we wanted to briefly discuss the last couple episodes of Heroes, because we've gotten some glimpses and some revelations have been shown to us.
Yep.
So, one of the things was we finally found out what the overall threat for the season was, where in season one it was going to be the destruction of New York. In season two, we found out it's going to be a virus that it starts with the heroes and it mutates and it starts killing off everybody, basically. And 1 year into the future, we find out Peter goes to the future and 93% of the Earth's population is wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
This was a mixed bag for me.
Okay.
Because he goes to New York, of all places, and it's deserted, and it's in ruins, and everyone's dead. It smacked a little bit too much of last season.
So, yeah. Yeah, I think that's how everyone felt. I felt the same way. Because what's been happening is that Peter has lost his memory, and he's been trying to retrace his steps, so to speak, and track things down. And he went to a lot of clues were leading him to Montreal. He goes to Montreal and he gets into this building and he sees a note from someone named Adam saying that Adam and Peter have to save the world. And then all of a sudden, just like Eric says, Peter jumps into the future and sees New York. And yeah, that's exactly what happened last season. With Hero and the bomb in New York. So I think all of the Heroes fam collectively kind of gasped and just were like, really? But then going into this past episode,
on the flip side of the coin, we were wondering who Adam was. And
Adam is he's been a little controversy.
Yeah, Adam Monroe. What we knew was he was known by the original Heroes, the first generation. What we found out was he was the one also manipulating Matt's dad and also Jessica, and that Linderman was a disciple of Adam.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of seeing, well, Adam's not really the good guy that maybe we thought he was when we saw the note with Peter. So then We've been being treated to the hero in ancient feudal Japan storyline, and the continuing story of Takezo Kensei, and who is Hiro's childhood hero. And Hiro was trying to mold this guy into a hero. He was kind of a drunkard, irresponsible guy when Hiro found him, and Hiro molded him into a hero, and then fell in love with the girl Kensei was supposed to fall in love with, and betrayed Kensei with this princess. And so Kensei was left turning against Hiro. Within this episode, we saw the end of the conclusion of that storyline in feudal Japan, where we thought Kensei died, but before he did, he told Hiro, "You will suffer." And then we thought he died in an explosion. What was revealed later on in the episode was Kensei somehow survived. We know he can regenerate, but he survived to modern day, and he is Adam Monroe.
Right.
So that was huge for me. I was like, oh, that's good.
Yeah, I kind of had been assuming that. I actually didn't think about it until the beginning of the episode. Because, like, you've seen after Kensei felt betrayed by Hiro, like, he started to take a turn for the worse. And I really felt like, I was actually looking online today, but really when you saw that explosion, you saw that you thought Kensei was dead, it really was like, that is the birth of a supervillain. Like, you saw the look in his eyes, and like Eric said, the last thing that he said to Hiro is that you will suffer, and then there was an explosion, I was like, okay, like, Kensei is gonna be back, and he's gonna be a villain.
Yeah, when the body, quote-unquote body, showed up, I was like, that's not him. You know, they've spent too long developing that character to where we know he has some power. He's gonna show up somewhere again. I didn't expect him to be Adam, though. I didn't know how they were gonna use him. So that was kind of a shock to me that I really enjoyed. But I also see he's Linderman Prime. Like, he's more evil than Linderman was. And I think there's gonna be a lot of potential with that supervillain character. And again in this series, I don't know if it's the actors they chose or how the story's been progressing, but for some reason to me, like, the supervillains have been almost more interesting than the heroes.
No, it's, yeah, they've been doing a damn good job, and I liked how they, I mean, they set him up. I mean, they were basically setting up the backstory for this character, and we didn't even know it, and so already we know that, like, his motivation, you know, we know how he took a turn for the worse, and so it's very interesting to see what he's been doing for the past, you know, 300 years.
Yeah. Another thing that was introduced last episode was the idea of expanded powers. And this was introduced with Matt, where his father can produce images in the mind and basically any thing, you know, he can manipulate brainwaves to make people see things, make people do things. And with Matt's powers, Matt's just been able to read minds, but what we found out was he's got all this untapped potential that he hasn't been using yet. And so that makes you wonder what some of the other heroes can use.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost the idea of secondary mutation.
Yeah, it's cool that, I mean, their powers are going to develop more. I think that that's a really cool dynamic. I am very, very excited about this next episode coming up, because we finally see what happened between the end of Season 1 and the gap in Season 2, which was 4 months. And so we finally see what happens with Nathan and Peter when they fly off. We find out how Peter got into the little, you know, train car or whatever. But also in the scenes was something that I haven't even thought about, was you see the Haitian with Peter. Because we know that Peter has lost his memories, but I didn't even think about how that the Haitian might be involved in that.
Well, yeah, when they found Peter, he was wearing the Haitian's necklace.
He's wearing the necklace, but I was like, I don't think that the Haitian would have taken his memories, because that makes no sense. And I'm like, oh, well, okay, well, and that's what the show does. Like, sometimes the answers are, like, right in front of you, and you don't even see it.
Yeah, it'll take the most obvious thing and then lead you down the next path over, and then you're like, oh, well, of course, you know, that's what's great about this show. And so I'm excited about it. Unfortunately, I hope the writer's strike does not affect this show anymore.
I think it probably will.
So,
but it's good that, I mean, a lot of people have been skeptical of the show, and they've been talking about how it's in a sophomore slump, and I think that the past couple of episodes have really been like a sign to fans that are saying, like, you know, the show is still where it used to be. And I think after this past episode, there shouldn't be a doubt in anyone's mind that, like, there is no sophomore slump and that this show is just as good as it's always been.
Right, right. So some other things we want to talk about. Smallville's been pretty good lately. David, you want to talk about that?
Yes, I just want to touch on this last episode of Smallville, which was actually, it was very, very interesting. Kara is on the show now, and she's been like the modern version of Kara. You don't know if she's good or bad. And it got a little bit confusing, but what you found out is that Lara, Clark's mother, actually goes to Smallville because she knows that if Krypton is destroyed, that she wants to meet the family and know where her son's going to be. And at this point, she's with Kara, and Zor-El, Kara's father, shows up. And you find out that Zor-El was in love with Lara. And Lara obviously didn't feel the same way, but Zor-El has a crystal. And basically, Zor-El knows that Krypton also might be destroyed, and in this crystal, he inputs Lara's DNA, so that if Krypton really is destroyed, then basically Lara can be cloned and the Kryptonian race can go on. A little bit morbid, but okay. So this cuts to the fact that when Kara was on, or crash-landed on Earth, she has this crystal. And it's stolen from her by the government, and so the whole arc of the season so far has been Kara focused on getting her crystal back. So she finally tracks it down, and she goes to get the crystal, and it's gone before she gets there. And so the big mystery is what happened to the crystal. At this point, there's been a very good dynamic between Kara and Clark, because Clark has been looking after her. And it's been great that, like, Clark is looking after someone else for once, and that he's worried about her using her powers and her getting herself out there and being exposed, because it's always been people worrying about him. So we cut all the way to the end of the episode, and we find out that Clark was the one who stole the crystal. And we find out that Clark is basically thinking about Clonia's mother. And it was a really good, shocking, you know, end, because it's Clark kind of taking a dark turn, but not, like, he's not making that choice with, like, dark intent in his heart. Like, you know, he's always been alone, he's always wanted to know his parents, and he's always had that special connection of, like, really wanting to know who his mother is. And so you really feel bad for him, because he has this opportunity to see his mother and to be with his mother, and pretty much anyone would probably be thinking the same thing, but you know how it's going to turn out.
Yeah.
So it's just another thing that we've talked about, how Smallville for, you know, 3 years in the middle was not very good, but starting with last season, season 6, and going into this season, it's just been very, very good.
Yeah, I think that's a really kind of nice place to take this character, because that's really the fascinating aspect, is like, you know, what would he do if he could get his Kryptonian heritage back?
Right.
So that's always an interesting idea to explore, and one that's not really been done on the show all that much. So, yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing how good that show has come back, you know, to be.
Yeah, I didn't think it would be able to redeem itself, to be honest.
I thought it was going to kind of just get worse and worse, and then just fade away into TV obscurity, but you know, if you're going to finish it strong, because it has been a really good TV series. So
yep, I agree.
So okay, well, the last thing we want to talk about is a big DVD release last week was Spider-Man 3, and David bought the Blu-ray.
I got the Blu-ray trilogy,
and I just have the regular version, but we want to talk about a little bit of the special features, just kind of promo the disc a bit. I'll let David go first.
You know, I had mixed feelings about Spider-Man 3 when I first saw it. I was a little bit overwhelmed. I thought there was a lot that they put into the movie. Going back and seeing it again on DVD, in terms of the movie, you know, I think it's... I'm not disappointed with the movie at all. I think that it is my least favorite of the three, but I still love the movie. I am still a little bit disappointed with the Venom aspect of the movie, because I don't think Venom was done justice, but looking back, I was so impressed with how they handled Harry and how they brought Harry back and had him redeem himself. I thought that was a really unexpected way to go, and I'd have to say kudos to the writers and Sam Raimi doing that, because it really was touching. Like, every time I watch the end of the movie and I see Harry, you know, give himself for Peter and die, like, I'm really feeling for the character at that point. And that's something I would not have expected to have felt. So I have to say that. DVD-wise, you know, Sony has put out a great DVD on Blu-ray. I'm not sure who out there has a Blu-ray player, but you can definitely tell the difference. The sound was amazing. The special features with the Sandman, with the special effects with Venom were also really good. So, I mean, I would just have to say, in terms of the Blu-ray DVD, definitely a 10 out of 10, the highest quality I could give it.
Yeah. Mainly, I wanted to talk about the special features. There's several featurettes which spotlight different characters in the movie, mainly the new characters, and specifically the one with Venom. You know, David, you have your issues with that based on your preconception of Venom in the comics and the cartoons,
right,
and everything like that. I thought Venom was done very well. From how I knew him, which is primarily the cartoon, I thought he was done extremely well in the movie. I thought Topher Grace did a very good job as a somewhat, you know, slimy, cocky Eddie Brock. Mm-hmm. I know it's different from the Eddie Brock in the comics.
No, I don't think. I agree with you in everything that you say. I just think that there should have been more Venom. But that was my only concern.
Yeah. But I thought, aside from all that, I thought visually Venom was spectacular to look at.
Oh, yeah.
That was something, like, brought to the big screen, that was something that was very, very impressive. And it was very cool to go in and see how they developed Venom from even the goo that crashes on the meteorite. You know, how he...
It's the symbiote. Show some respect. You just called the symbiote a goo.
It's goo. It's gack. Remember, it's gack.
You got some real issues.
You could put it against the newspaper and take prints away. So,
I hate you.
Yeah, I know. no, it was really interesting, like, how it bonds with Peter, and then how it bonds with Eddie Brock, and the different stages of development the Venom goes through, from how he initially looks to how he looks at the very end when he doesn't even have Eddie Brock inside of him anymore, and how they went about all of that. It was very mm-hmm. interesting. And probably one of the things, watching this on DVD, I was very overwhelmed, like David was, the first time I saw it in the theater too. And it seemed like every time I saw it a couple times in the theater, and I just always walked away like tired. I was like, God, that was a lot to go on for 2.5 hours. Like, I just didn't really soak it in. Watching it on DVD, I really came away more sympathetic towards Sandman than I had, I guess, originally. And Thomas Hayden Church did a fantastic job with him. And the thing about him is he's got a very, very expressive face. And they
that's true.
They brought a... When it was some of the digital effects with just the sand, they implemented his facial expression into the sand, and there's some great scenes that just kind of give me a lump in my throat, which happens a lot.
You're always going to lump in your throat.
But it was emotional, like how when he's first trying to pick up that locket, he can't quite get it. And you really do feel for the character. And it's amazing the amount of effect that it took to create that look on the big screen in such a realistic way. And there's a bunch of other special features featuring Gwen Stacy, and they talk about Norman Osborn, Harry Osborn, and redesigning the Goblin outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And which was pretty interesting. And so it was really good. It's got packed special features. Even on regular DVD, the movie looks fantastic. The sound is fantastic. So definitely something to pick up and put in your library.
And okay, now going off into movie news, there's a couple of things we got to hit real quick, and that's that they've signed a writer on to do a Green Lantern movie, and they've also signed a writer to do a Flash movie. And this is basically, these are supposed to spin off of the JLA movie, the live action movie that they're going to be making.
I don't know if Green Lantern is supposed to.
Well, they're supposed to be like branching off, because we don't know if the Green Lantern in the JLA movie is going to be Hal Jordan yet.
It's
going to
be John Stewart, is what they said.
Because everyone's assuming it's going to be John Stewart. First of all, what do we think about a JLA movie? Because I am completely against it.
I worry. Boy, do I worry. I think it could. I'm not going to say it could be horrible. Like, it could be horrible. Team superhero movies are not typically done a whole lot. But let's look at the example of, like, X-Men and X2. If you keep the cast down to a certain number, and you don't try and get over-ambitious, but just you know, stick to the true feeling of the comic book and the characters. Don't stray and just let the writers do whatever they want. I think it could be done potentially well. I think it's going to get complicated, and now we're going to do it in the movies too, but I think people are going to get confused, like, well, does Batman Begins relate to the Justice League? And it's not going to. Justice League is going to be separate from other DC continuity, but then also they said that it might relate to the Superman movies, so...
All I can say is, and I very, very strongly believe this, they should not at all make a JLA movie or the Avengers. Those movies are off limits. You can't do it.
It's just going to be really, really hard, and to spend all that screen time developing, you know, characters.
Each and every one of these characters. Yeah. And, like, you have to give more attention to Superman and Batman. You have to, because they're the most famous, the most well-known.
They're the money makers.
And then everything else is just back up. And, it's a bad idea. Like, I believe so strongly that it's such a bad idea. And, you know, I might eat my words, you know. I will be the first to admit I'm wrong if I'm wrong. But I just believe that it's just... I think that, like, this... Like, a JLA movie, the idea of Avengers movie, because they've talked about how they wanted to hire a writer to do that. I think that that's, like... You know, some of the comic book movies that are coming out right now are already a little bit much stuff that shouldn't be made, and I think that this would be, like, the beginning of the end. Like, I really do. Like, this is getting a little bit too ambitious.
Yeah, this... It does seem a little bit like a cash-in. The problem with this is... Whereas in the X-Men movies, you've got maybe one or two X-Men that people know. Like, okay, well, I know Cyclops and Wolverine. And then the rest of them are kind of secondary characters that a lot of people aren't that invested in. The problem with that is Justice League, yeah, even though Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman are the big three, still a lot of people know about Green Lantern and Flash and, you know, Aquaman. And it's going to be really hard to have that many... egos in the room, we'll say. Because it's going to be really hard with all those huge characters. It's not like any of them are minimal. They're in their respect, like, we all, or most of us grew up watching Super Friends or stuff like that, or the old Aquaman cartoon or Wonder Woman on TV. You know, it's like all these characters have been a part of popular culture for a long time to where we all know them on some level.
Right.
Whether it's a passing interest or a passing level or we... you know, read the comics or whatever. So it's going to be really hard to spend, you know, 2 hours with all of those personalities.
Exactly. Basically, anyone in the Justice League, for the most part, could have their own movie.
Yeah.
So it's really not needed to put them all in a movie together. Like, I just feel like it's a bad idea. They should be more worried about getting Wonder Woman off its feet, because it's been in, you know, pre-production for years.
Or a Flash.
You know, was that?
Or the Flash movie. That was, you know, there's been scripts for years.
Yeah, I think the Flash would be... The Flash should be where all their attention should be focused for DC, at least right now. So, I don't know. Like, I'm very, very nervous, because it's not like... It's one of those things where... I mean, any comic book movie that comes out right now, especially a big, huge comic book movie, like, it doesn't just really affect that movie or DC. Like, it affects, like, the comic book industry as a whole. You know, it wouldn't take much for, like, this comic book movie fad to slowly just fade away.
Yeah, it's true. And this one seems like it's just going to be so easy to tip the scale. So, it's such a delicate thing. So... We'll see.
Let's hope for the best, I guess.
I say hesitantly. So, I'm not by any means... The thing is, like, with Superman Returns and The Dark Knight, like, I was really excited the second, like, they even announced they were working on it. And I was just like, oh, yes! You know, the fanboy inside me was just craving it. With this, like, I'm just not excited at all. I'm
scared. I feel the exact same way.
Yeah. And I feel
that's... Even, like, like, even right now, like, they're trying to get the voices for some of these characters for the JLA, and people are just turning them down, like, role after role, and so they're going to be, like, it's not going to be, like, B-level actors doing these voices, but it's not going to be, like, you know, A-level either. So it's kind of like, come on, just, like,
yeah,
I don't know. I'm not a writer, so I can't say anything.
Well, I mean, It could be done, but
it could be good. It could be good. I'll be the first one to say, okay, I could be wrong.
But I mean, it's just it's gonna be very difficult. Even looking at the Justice League cartoon, it didn't even really get interesting until the second season. And by that time, you had developed relationships between the characters and stuff like that to where you were a little bit more invested in them. So it's going to be hard to do an introductory movie with a team of egos this big. So with that, I think that wraps it up for us this week. So if you have any feedback for us or anything like that, any ideas or questions that you want to address on the show, you can contact us on email at contact@fanboystrikeback.com. You can also go to our website, www.fanboystrikeback.com, and there is where we post our comic book reviews for the week. We post movie news, trailers, anything that kind of sparks our interest. And on that website is a link to our forums page where we have posted topics that we want to talk about, and we'd like to see you guys on there. And if you want to, you can go on and post a topic, and you know, we can talk about it there. It's a good way to address ideas that we don't talk about in the show. So with that, we also have MySpace.
Right. You can head over to myspace.com/thefanboystrikeback. Come check out our MySpace page. Be our friend. We also do our Book of the Week blog there on our MySpace page, so you can check that out. And then you can catch our podcast on any podcatcher. If you do listen to us on iTunes or Podcast Alley, please try to leave us a review, positive, negative. Any feedback is always good. We always take that to heart because we're always trying to make the show, you know, better. And I think that would be it. So I'm David.
I'm Eric.
And we will see you guys next week. Will I wake up to dream?